A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those prompts where I read it and went, oh, right, this is the actual thing nobody talks about. He's spending a few hours with Ezra today while Hannah's at a business event, and he's been listening to episodes of this very podcast while he does it, and he feels guilty about it. Not guilty enough to stop, obviously, but guilty enough to ask whether it's okay. His basic question is it harmful to parent while podcasting? And if it's not harmful, how do you structure it so you're not just a warm body in the room with earbuds in?
The guilt is the interesting part to me. He's doing something that, by his own description, leaves his visual attention fully on the baby. Low volume audio from a phone speaker, not headphones, eyes on Ezra, periodically pausing to interact. And yet the guilt is still there. That's not a parenting question. That's a cultural question.
And I think it's worth naming what this moment actually is. It's June 2026, and we are at peak ambient parenting content. Podcasts, audiobooks, low-volume screen media that parents half-watch while doing floor time. The whole category has exploded. And alongside that explosion, there's this counter-narrative forming that says any divided attention is developmental neglect. Productivity parenting is suddenly the villain. So you've got parents caught between two messages. Use your time well, and never split your focus. Those two things cannot both be true.
If you're a parent doing 8 hours of solo caregiving with a pre-verbal child, the cognitive reality is that your brain needs something. And I don't mean that as a luxury, I mean that as a neurological fact. Sustained attention on a single, low-stimulation target for hours at a stretch is not how human brains evolved to function. The guilt comes from the idea that wanting intellectual stimulation while caregiving is somehow a failure of present. But presence isn't the same thing as sensory deprivation.
No, and I think the confession he opened with is the thing that makes this real. He said, if I was just spending hours looking at him, I would die of boredom even if I didn't have ADHD. That's a raw sentence. Most parents won't say that out loud.
Most parents won't, but most parents feel it. And the ADHD addition is important here because for neurodivergent parents, the understimulation problem isn't just unpleasant, it's dysregulating. A parent who is emotionally dysregulated from boredom is not a more present parent. They're a parent who is white-knuckling through the day and probably less attuned than they would be with a podcast in one ear. But we should get into that later.
But let's sit with the guilt for a second, because I think the guilt is the actual thing Daniel is asking about, even if he framed it as a practical question about break frequency. He said he feels guilty every time. He pauses to make sounds with Ezra, he engages, but the guilt persists. And the thing that struck me is, he built this entire podcast, this whole library of episodes, partially so it would exist for exactly this purpose. He created the thing he needed, and then felt bad about using it. That's not a contradiction. That's a window into how deep the judgment around split attention goes.
It's almost like he pre-forgave himself by building the infrastructure first. I made this thing so I could listen to it while parenting, and now I'm listening to it while parenting, and I feel guilty. The logic is circular, but the emotion is real.
I think that's the entry point for this whole conversation. Because if we can untangle whether the guilt is justified, or whether it's just ambient cultural noise, then the practical question of how often to pause and engage becomes a lot easier to answer. If the guilt is the problem, not the podcast, then the solution isn't to stop listening. It's to build a better framework for when and how you re-engage.
That framework starts with defining what we're actually talking about here, because the term hasn't really settled yet, but I've been seeing it pop up in parenting research circles. Using low-volume audio content as a kind of cognitive life raft during caregiving. It's not background noise in the traditional sense. It's not a screen the kid can see. It's a podcast or an audiobook played quietly from a phone speaker while the parent's eyes and hands and body are still fully available to the child.
A cognitive life raft. I like that. Because the implication is that without it, you're drowning. And I think a lot of parents recognize that feeling but don't have language for it. The hours between naps can feel oceanic. You're not doing anything wrong. You're not a bad parent. but your brain is screaming for something to hold on to.
And the core tension here is real and worth naming directly. You have the parent's need for intellectual stimulation, for adult thought, for something that isn't just the sensory world of a preverbal child. And you have the child's need for attuned presence, for a caregiver who is emotionally available and responsive. Those two needs are both legitimate. Neither one is selfish. The question is whether they can coexist, or whether one necessarily cannibalizes the other.
I think the guilt Daniel described comes from the suspicion that they can't coexist, that any cognitive resource you allocate to the podcast is a resource you've stolen from the baby. It's a zero-sum model of attention. Either you're fully there or you're not. There's no middle ground.
Which is a very modern, very Western way of thinking about attention. And I want to be careful here because we haven't gotten to the research yet, and I know we're going to dig into the actual science of infant attention detection. But even before we get to the studies, it's worth asking whether the guilt itself is the problem, not the podcast.
Say more about that.
Guilt is a cognitive load of its own. If you're spending 2% of your attention on a podcast, and 15% of your attention on feeling terrible about the podcast, you've now lost 17% of your attention that could have been on the baby. The guilt is doing more harm than the thing you feel guilty about. And that's not just a self-help platitude. There's actual work on parental guilt and its effects on interaction quality. A parent who is anxious and guilty is less spontaneous, less playful, more rigid in their responses.
The guilt is a second-order problem that might be worse than the first-order problem.
It might be. And I think that's the reframe that makes this whole conversation possible. Because if we're asking, is it okay to parent while podcasting, the guilt says no, obviously not, you should be ashamed. But if we ask instead, what kind of split attention actually harms a child, and what kind is just the normal reality of being a human adult with a human brain, suddenly, we're in a different conversation entirely.
And the normal reality piece matters, because I think there's this unspoken assumption that good parenting means sustained, uninterrupted, devoted attention to the child for hours at a time. And that's not how any human culture has ever parented, historically or cross-culturally. It's not even how most parents in our own culture actually parent. It's an ideal that exists mainly to make people feel inadequate.
The gap between the ideal and the reality is basically a guilt factory, and it runs 24/7.
Let me try to frame what this episode is really about, because I think it's three nested questions. First, at the neurological level, can a baby actually tell the difference between a parent who's listening to a podcast and a parent who's scrolling Instagram? Does the sensory channel matter? Second, at the developmental level, if there is a difference, how much continuous full attention does a child actually need for healthy attachment and brain development? And third, at the practical level, if we accept that some degree of split attention is inevitable and maybe even healthy for the parent, how do you structure it intentionally so the child gets what they need and the parent doesn't lose their mind?
That's the episode. And the third question is the one that I think will actually help people, because it's not about permission. Permission is easy. Anyone can say, sure, go ahead, you're fine. It's about building a framework that honors both sets of needs, the child's need for attunement and the parent's need for cognitive survival.
I think it's worth flagging something before we get into the weeds. The fact that Daniel built this podcast for exactly this purpose and still feels guilty about using it tells us that the guilt isn't responding to evidence. It's not saying, I've noticed, my child seems less connected when I listen. It's saying, I have internalized a standard so absolute that even using a tool I created for myself feels like a moral failure.
That's the cultural artifact piece. The guilt is not coming from the baby. The baby is not sitting there thinking, father is listening to a podcast, I am being developmentally neglected. The baby is thinking, is this face making interesting sounds at me? And can I reach that thing over there? The guilt is coming from a culture that has decided that any parental activity that isn't directly child-focused is suspect.
It's a culture that, let's be honest, is particularly harsh on mothers. The prompt came from a father, and I think fathers get a version of this too, but the ambient judgment around maternal attention is absolutely relentless. If a mom has one earbud in during tummy time, there's a corner of the internet that will diagnose her as disengaged and damaging her child's attachment. Meanwhile, the same culture will tell her she should be listening to educational podcasts to optimize herself. It's completely incoherent.
The optimization culture meets the attachment culture, and the result is that you're supposed to be simultaneously maximally present and maximally productive, and the only thing you're actually maximizing is guilt.
Let's do what we always do. Let's actually look at what babies can perceive, what the research says about split attention, and then build something practical. Because my working hypothesis is that the guilt is the real problem, and the podcast is fine. But I'm open to being wrong.
I suspect you're mostly right, but with some important caveats about what fine actually looks like in practice. And that's where the science gets interesting. There's a foundational study I keep coming back to on this. Striano and colleagues, 2006. They showed that infants as young as 5 months showed distinct brain responses to contingent versus non-contingent gaze. Contingent meaning, I look at you, you look back at me, there's a reciprocal loop. Non-contingent meaning, I'm looking in your direction, but my attention is somewhere else entirely. And 5-month-olds can already tell the difference. Their brains process it differently.
The baby knows. That's the unsettling part. You can't fake presence with a 5-month-old.
You really can't. And this is where the still face paradigm comes in, which is one of those experiments that sounds almost cruel until you understand what it revealed. Edward Tronick, 1978. A mother plays normally with her infant, smiling, cooing, the usual back and forth. Then the researcher asks her to go completely neutral. No expression, no response, just a still face. Within 2 minutes, the infant becomes visibly distressed. They try everything. They smile, they point, they reach out, they make sounds. When none of it works, they collapse into withdrawal and crying.
That's all it takes.
2 minutes of non-responsiveness, and the baby's entire regulatory system goes haywire. Cortisol spikes, heart rate changes, they start self-soothing behaviors like thumb-sucking or looking away. And the really striking thing is what happens in the reunion phase. When the mother goes back to normal, the infant is wary. It takes time to re-establish trust. The baby has learned, in that tiny window, that the caregiver might suddenly become unavailable.
The worst-case reading of this is, every time you put a podcast on, and your responsiveness drops even a little, you're doing a miniature still-face experiment on your own child.
That's the fear, right? And I think that's exactly the fear that drives the guilt Daniel described. But here's why that reading is wrong. The still-face paradigm is about complete affective withdrawal. No eye contact, no vocalization, no touch. That's not what ambient podcast listening looks like. When you're listening to a podcast at low volume with your eyes on the baby, you're still making faces, you're still mirroring sounds, you're still physically present. Your auditory channel is partially occupied, but your visual and tactile channels are fully online.
This is the distinction I think most of the guilt narratives miss. They collapse all split attention into one category, as if scrolling Twitter while your kid tugs at your sleeve is the same thing as having a quiet conversation in your ear while you make eye contact and do the raspberry game.
The research actually supports that distinction. The University of Cambridge did a major study on this in 2024, looking at what they called technoference, parental device use during caregiving. They found that when parents were actively on their phones, they produced about 40% fewer verbal responses to infant babbling. That's enormous. 40% fewer vocal turn-taking sequences. The baby makes a sound. The parent doesn't respond. The conversational loop breaks.
Which connects directly to the serve and return model.
Serve and return is the framework from Harvard Center on the Developing Child, 2014. It describes the back-and-forth interaction that literally builds neural architecture in the first 3 years. Baby serves, parent returns. Baby babbles, parent babbles back. Baby points, parent looks and names the thing. Those loops are what wire the brain for communication, for emotional regulation, for social cognition. They're not optional, they're foundational.
The terrifying 40% number from Cambridge is about phones. Visual attention hijacked, eyes down, thumb scrolling. And the question is, does a low-volume podcast produce the same 40% drop, or is something different happening?
The Cambridge study didn't look at audio only. Nobody has done that exact study yet, which is a gap in the literature. But we can extrapolate from what we know about sensory channels. Phone use occupies visual attention, manual attention, and cognitive attention all at once. You're looking at a screen, your hands are busy, and your brain is processing whatever you're reading. A podcast occupies auditory attention and some cognitive bandwidth, but leaves your eyes free, your hands free, and your body orientation toward the child intact.
The baby sees your face, sees your eyes, gets your physical presence, gets your touch. What they might not get is the same density of verbal response.
That's the trade-off, and it's a real trade-off. If you're listening to a podcast, you're probably talking less to the baby than you would in complete silence. The question is whether that reduction matters, given that you're still fully visually and physically present. And I think the answer depends on how you handle the re-engagement moments.
The serve and return doesn't have to be continuous. To be effective, it has to be reliable.
That's the key insight. Reliability over density. A parent who does 50 serve and return exchanges per hour with full presence is probably doing better than a parent who does 200 half-hearted ones while scrolling. The quality of the return matters more than the quantity. That quality is exactly where the attention budget model comes in, because I think it's the most useful way to think about this. Every parent has finite cognitive resources during caregiving. You're running a mental budget, and different activities draw from different accounts. Phone scrolling draws from visual, manual, and cognitive all at once. A podcast draws from auditory and some cognitive, but leaves the visual and tactile accounts fully funded for the baby.
Visual is the big one. If your eyes are on the baby, you catch the subtle cues. The slightly different eyebrow movement that means I'm about to get overwhelmed. The lip purse that means I'm processing something. The glance toward an object that means I'm curious. Those micro-signals are the raw material of attunement, and you miss every single one of them when you're looking at a screen.
And here's where the ADHD angle becomes really important, because I don't think we can treat this as a side note. For neurodivergent parents, monotasking on baby care can be genuinely dysregulating. An understimulated brain doesn't just get bored. It gets agitated, restless, emotionally brittle. And a dysregulated parent is not an attuned parent, no matter how many minutes of uninterrupted eye contact they're logging.
The podcast isn't a distraction from parenting. It's a regulation tool that makes parenting possible.
That's the reframe. The voice in your ear is keeping your arousal level in the sweet spot where you can actually be present rather than crawling out of your skin. And a parent who's calmly listening to a podcast while making eye contact and mirroring sounds is doing far better for that child than a parent who's white-knuckling through silent boredom and slowly dissociating.
I think this is where the guilt narratives get it exactly backwards. They treat the podcast as something you're doing instead of paying attention to your child. When for a lot of parents, the podcast is the thing that allows you to pay attention to your child without losing your mind.
This connects to Winnicott's concept of the good enough parent from 1953. Winnicott argued that the goal isn't perfect attunement, it's ordinary devotion, the parent who is present enough, responsive enough, reliable enough, not the parent who never misses a cue. The parent who misses cues and then repairs. The repair is actually where the child learns that relationships can withstand rupture.
The good enough parent. Not the optimal parent. Not the maximally stimulated parent. Not the parent who has read every paper on serve and return and is executing a curriculum. Just the parent who shows up, most of the time, with genuine warmth.
I think modern Western parenting culture has completely lost touch with that concept. We've replaced good enough with optimized, and the result is that anything short of total immersive presence feels like failure. But if you look cross-culturally, this standard is historically bizarre.
Give me an example.
The Aka foragers of Central Africa. Barry Hewlett's fieldwork in the early 90s documented that Aka infants are held about 80% of the day. They're carried while mothers process food, gather, socialize, do all the things. The infant is physically present, but the mother's attention is divided across multiple tasks. And yet, attachment security among Aka children is high, comparable to Western norms and in some measures higher.
The baby is physically close, gets touch, gets motion, gets the sensory experience of being near the caregiver, but is not the sole focus of attention for hours at a time. And that's not neglect. That's how humans have parented for most of history.
The Western nuclear family model, where one parent is alone with one infant in a quiet house for 8 hours, is the historical anomaly. In most cultures, caregiving is distributed across multiple adults and older children, and the primary caregiver is rarely doing nothing but attending to the baby.
which means the guild Daniel described are not giving Ezra 100% of my attention for hours, is guilt about failing to meet a standard that almost no human parent in history has ever met, and that children don't actually need.
It's guilt about not being a parenting robot, essentially.
Let's get practical. If we accept that ambient audio is fine, and that the real question is how you structure the re-engagement moments, what does that actually look like?
I've been thinking about this as the 10-minute reset. Here's the logic. Infant attention spans are naturally rhythmic. They focus, they disengage, they refocus. It's not continuous, so every 10 to 15 minutes you pause the podcast. Not for long, maybe 30 seconds. But in that window, you do three things. Full eye contact, mirror one sound the baby makes, and do one serve and return cycle. Baby coos, you coo back. Baby reaches, you name the object. Baby makes a face, you make the face back and add a sound.
It's not interrupting parenting to do the podcast. It's interrupting the podcast to do a focused parenting burst.
And the rhythm actually mimics what babies do naturally. They had these bursts of intense social engagement followed by periods where they look away, self-soothe, process. The 10-minute reset just aligns the parent's rhythm with the baby's natural cycle.
The reset doesn't have to be a big production. Pause after a segment ends, make a silly face, get a smile, mirror a babble, then hit play again. The baby gets a clear signal that says, "I see you, I hear you, we're connected." And then you both go back to what you were doing.
What I love about this is that it's not about measuring minutes of attention. It's about the quality and reliability of the re-engagement. A parent who does 5 genuine resets an hour is probably building more secure attachment than a parent who's half present for the full 60 minutes.
Which brings us back to the content question. Does it matter what you're listening to? Fiction versus nonfiction? High cognitive load versus low?
I think it does, and I think this is under-discussed. High cognitive load content, dense argumentation, something that requires you to hold multiple threads in working memory, that's going to pull more cognitive resources away from the baby. If you're trying to follow a complex philosophical argument, your verbal responsiveness is probably going to drop more than if you're listening to a narrative podcast or light conversation.
Maybe the move is, save the dense stuff for stroller walks or nap time, and use lower cognitive load content during active caregiving. This podcast, for what it's worth, is probably medium load. We're not reading academic papers aloud, but we're asking you to think.
The prompt's author specifically mentioned listening to episodes of this show. So I'd say, if you're doing the 10-minute reset and you're keeping your eyes on the baby, a medium load podcast is probably fine. The key is noticing if you're missing cues. If you realize you just spaced out through 3 babbles in a row, that's your signal to pause and re-engage.
The self-monitoring piece is maybe the most important practical takeaway. Not, am I a bad parent for listening to this, but am I still catching the important signals? If the answer is yes, carry on. If the answer is no, hit pause and do a reset.
That reset is exactly what I want to pull into something a listener can actually use tomorrow. The first one I'm calling the 2-second rule.
2 seconds sounds almost insultingly short. Like, congratulations, you looked at your child for the duration of a sneeze.
That's the point. The bar has to be low enough that you'll actually do it. Every time you pause the podcast for any reason, you spend a minimum of 2 seconds in full eye contact and you mirror one sound the baby just made. That's it. 2 seconds, one mirror. If you do that every time you pause across a day of caregiving, that adds up to dozens of micro connections you wouldn't have had otherwise.
The sound mirror is doing real neurological work. You're not just looking, you're saying, I heard you, I'm giving it back, we're in a conversation.
Second insight, schedule your podcast blocks during low interaction windows. Tummy time, stroller walks, the post-nap quiet alertness phase where the baby's just blinking at the ceiling processing existence. Those are periods where the baby doesn't need high-density verbal interaction from you anyway. Stack your listening there, and save the high interaction windows for full engagement.
You're matching your podcast rhythm to the baby's natural rhythm instead of fighting it. The baby's in a quiet processing mode. You're in a quiet listening mode. You're both doing parallel but compatible things.
Third one's about the guilt itself. If you feel guilty, try this reframe. You are modeling that parents are whole humans with needs. That is a gift, not a failure. A child who grows up seeing a parent who has interests, who stays intellectually alive, who regulates their own boredom in a healthy way, that child is learning something profound about what adulthood looks like.
The alternative is modeling that parenthood means erasing yourself, which is not actually a gift to anyone, least of all the child, who then internalizes that love equals self-annihilation.
The fourth one is specifically for ADHD parents. Use the podcast as a body double. The voice in your ear functions the same way a friend sitting next to you while you work functions. It anchors you, keeps you grounded, prevents the mental drift that leads to phone scrolling or dissociation. The podcast isn't competing with your attention. It's the scaffolding that makes attention possible.
The voice is keeping you in the room, and because you're in the room, you're actually more present than you would be without it. That's the counterintuitive piece that I think most guilt narratives completely miss.
Which brings me to the question I keep coming back to. What if the guilt is the only real problem?
Meaning the child is actually fine. The guilt is the thing causing damage, not the podcast.
We've spent this whole conversation establishing that babies can tell when attention is split, that there are measurable effects, that you need to structure re-engagement intentionally. All of that is true. But also, a parent listening to low-volume audio while maintaining visual contact and doing periodic resets, that parent's child is almost certainly getting enough. The guilt is the parasite. It eats cognitive bandwidth, it makes you stiff and self-conscious, it turns what could be a relaxed afternoon into a performance review you're failing.
The guilt is the cognitive load that actually reduces responsiveness. You're so busy monitoring yourself. Am I a bad parent right now? Am I doing this wrong? That you're less spontaneous, less playful, less attuned to the actual baby in front of you. The guilt is the distraction, not the podcast.
I think this is where the whole ambient parenting conversation needs to go next. We're about to have a lot more tools for this. Audio-only smart glasses are already on the market. AI companions that can whisper reminders, track your baby's patterns, suggest when to do a reset. The technology is going to proliferate faster than our cultural frameworks for using it.
The default response to every new parenting technology is a moral panic. Screens are rotting their brains. Podcasts are making you a distracted parent. AI is going to replace human connection. The pattern is always the same. New tool appears. Someone writes a scary headline. Guilt spikes. Nobody actually develops a thoughtful framework for intentional use.
What we need instead of blanket bans is exactly what we've been doing here. What channel does this tool occupy? What does it leave free? How do you structure re-engagement? What's the actual mechanism by which it could cause harm? And can you design around that mechanism?
The question is never, is this tool good or bad for parenting? The question is, how do you use it in a way that preserves what matters? For audio, what matters is that the baby knows you see them, hear them, and will respond when they reach out. If the podcast doesn't break that circuit, it's fine.
I'd go further. I think the next few years are going to force this conversation. Ambient computing is moving into the home in a big way. Always on audio, wearable AI, voice agents that live in the nursery. Parents are going to be navigating this whether the parenting books catch up or not.
The move is to get ahead of it. Develop the frameworks now. Intentional use, channel awareness, structured re-engagement, guilt as the actual enemy. Not throw your phone in the lake and stare at your baby for 12 hours.
Which nobody has ever done, including our grandparents, who absolutely had the radio on while they were folding laundry with a baby on the hip.
It's the same pattern with different delivery mechanisms. The child knows when you're truly there. They know it from your eyes, your voice, your hands, your warmth. And those things can all be present even if your ears are busy.
That's the note I want to end on. The child knows. Not the child is tracking your attention with a stopwatch. Not the child is building a trauma narrative because you listened to 40 minutes of conversation while they stacked blocks. But the child knows when your face lights up at their sound. The child knows when you mirror their babble. The child knows when you scoop them up and they feel held. Those are the things that build the bond. And a podcast at low volume doesn't stop any of them from happening.
If you're the parent who sent this prompt, sitting on the floor with your pre-verbal kid and feeling guilty about the episode playing in the background, here's the reframe. You're not splitting your attention. You're sharing your space. You're letting your child see that adults have minds that stay alive. The curiosity doesn't die when you become a parent. That you can be interested in the world and still be completely available when it counts. That's not a failure. That's modeling something real.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, plantation owners on Mauritius reported that enslaved Madagascan laborers played a board game called Fanarona at a pace so rapid the stones produced a percussive clatter audible across cane fields, a sound one overseer described as rain on a tin roof played at double speed.
Rain on a tin roof at double speed. That's the game you want to lose quietly.
And thank you to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for that journey into 19th century board game acoustics.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes like this one, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review if you're feeling generous. It helps other tired parents find us.
You're doing better than you think. We'll be here when you need us.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.